From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
Really, I want people to understand that this is a work in progress, right? Our story has not been told in its entirety. So there are new questions, new ways to engage, new conversations to have, and I'm hopeful that people will take advantage of that opportunity.
Dr. Monique W. Morris, co-founder and president of the National Black Women's Justice Institute, and author of Black Stats, African Americans by the Numbers in the 21st Century, published by New Press. Black Stats, African Americans by the Numbers, a book of quantitative facts that illustrate the quality of black life in America. It covers a broad spectrum of topics from basic demographic and entertainment to the environment, military, and electoral politics. Morris's book is a critical tool for advocates, educators, and policymakers. It offers indispensable information that is sure to enlighten discussions and provoke debate about the quality of black life in this country today and help chart the path to a better tomorrow. Did you know there are less than 250,000 black public school teachers in this country, representing just 7% of all teachers in public schools? I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Black Stats, African Americans by the Numbers in the 21st Century, with author Dr. Monique W. Morris, In Black America.
We are a very giving, civically engaged people. And so we should absolutely use that as a way for us to enter conversations about where we go next, you know, both in terms of what we do to apply these data, but also how we utilize the resources that I list in the back of the book. I include a list of resources and additional information sites. So I'm hoping that people will take advantage of the opportunity, along with their websites, it's all included in the book, to really go to these websites and spend some time there and, you know, look at how our story emerges and develops over time.
Dr. Monique W. Morris is an author, scholar, and social justice advocate with more than 20 years of professional and volunteer experience in the areas of education, civil rights, juvenile, and social justice. She has written dozens of articles, book chapters, and other publications on social justice issues and lectures widely on politics, research practices associated with improving juvenile justice, educational and socioeconomic conditions for black girls, women, and their families. In her new publication, Black Stats, African Americans by the Numbers in the 21st Century, Morris has put together a comprehensive guide filled with contemporary facts and figures on African Americans. The book is an essential reference for anyone attempting to fathom the complex state of our nation. With fascinating and often surprising information on everything from incarceration rates, lending practices, and the arts to marriage, voting habits, and green jobs, the contextualized material in this book will better attune readers to telling trends while challenging common-held yet often misguided perceptions.
I was always interested in history, English, and I went to a I went to a very good and well-resourced high school in San Francisco, and so my favorite subjects tended to be the ones that I created for myself. I did a number of independent studies that were oriented toward African American history and studies, just because I always knew that I would study some form of Africana studies in college, and so I wanted to make sure I was prepared for that. But my interest in learning more about the sort of history and social construct and conditions of black America led me to create a number of independent studies while in high school, and those tended to be my favorite subjects.
Tell us about your experience at the NAACP.
Yeah, I was there for a couple of years working with Benjamin Jealous, and I was the vice president for advocacy and research and then for economic programs, working with a national team to support the development of the national agenda alongside the board of directors and the thousands of volunteers and local units that engage in this work daily. I loved the NAACP's attention to, you know, responding to the conditions of black America. I loved the opportunity to work with a stellar, very talented national team to help develop national frameworks and narratives to address, you know, racial and economic and social inequality.
And you also worked at the Berkeley Law School?
Yeah, I was the director of research for the Thelton Henderson Center for Social Justice at UC Berkeley's Law School prior to joining the NAACP. And was also their senior research fellow, and so was able to lead and engage in research that examined the impact of anti-affirmative action legislation in California, and also lead research on the barriers to employment for formerly incarcerated women.
So I assume that you and Ward Conley are not speaking buddies.
We are not speaking buddies. You assume correctly.
Tell us about the National Black Women's Justice Institute.
Yes, I started the National Black Women's Justice Institute with my partner, Dr. Stephanie Bush Basquet, largely in response to some of the conditions that we were both recognizing and have recognized over the years to be part of an underdeveloped narrative about justice and equality. The conditions of women and girls, particularly Black women and girls, though they represent or they're disproportionately overrepresented in many of the sort of indicators and pathways that lead to confinement, they're also, and you know, certainly among those who are actually incarcerated, they have yet to really be centered in discussions about how we engage in community development and responses that are both gender responsive and culturally competent. So one of the things, you know, the primary reason, you know, for really coming together to say we're going to launch this institute, which is in its embryonic stages, is to center the conditions of Black women, girls, and their families in discussions about racial and gender inequality and in conversations about criminalization and responses to that criminalization.
Now, we all know there's been an emphasis since the Trayvon Martin incident and prior to that on African-American young men. Why hasn't it been such a similar push for African-American girls and women of color?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I think there are two ways to respond to that question. First, the situations with Trayvon Martin and Jordan Davis and others are so egregious and disappointing and heartbreaking, you know, that they capture the public's attention in a way that, you know, really give us concrete examples about the dehumanization of Black life. And so, you know, they have been centered in discussions about, you know, what's happening in our communities and have led to other or have been part of other conversations that have centered males in our discourses about equality and justice reform, et cetera. And as you say, you rightfully discuss, that has led to an exclusion of Black women and girls in conversations about justice. Though, you know, as I often say when I'm talking about these issues with people in our community or in our communities, Black boys, Black girls, they're sharing schools, they're sharing homes, they're sharing conditions, they're sharing exploitation, they're sharing surveillance, they're sharing incarceration. And so by not examining the ways in which these systems and structures also impact them, we're really doing our communities a disservice. There's a lot of reasons why Black girls' conditions are not a part of the narrative, some of them having to do with how we've even constructed the framework about how we see these problems and how we want to talk about these problems. For example, you know, most of our conversations about the justice system have focused in on incarceration.
Right.
If we look only at incarceration, we're going to see disproportionately males, and it's going to render other aspects of the reach of the criminal justice system invisible, and also going to render those who are disproportionately represented in those areas as invisible. So, you know, one of the things that I have asked our community to do is to think about, you know, even our justice reform agenda through a lens of criminalization, not necessarily incarceration only, because it broadens the lens and allows us to engage and enter this conversation differently.
Obviously, since you mentioned, you know, they go to school together, they live in the same neighborhood, so the challenges that they face are similar to the challenges that their male counterparts face also?
Yeah, many of the challenges are similar. You know, the criminalization is similar, the exposure to zero tolerance policies is similar, the exclusionary discipline, right, the suspensions, the expulsions, the constraint, those are all similar. Many of the cases that have involved the youngest of our children who have been impacted by these policies have actually been girls, girls who have had bad tantrums, schools respond with law enforcement, you know, so some of the, you know, many of the ways in which we engage in conversations, even about what is understood as a school-to-prison pipeline, do disproportionately affect our girls. And yet, you know, we still don't really talk about or center their experiences the same way. Girls are also, though, uniquely impacted by some of these policies because they tend to be disproportionately represented among those who are isolated or excluded from school or marginalized in some way from school because of how they dress, right? If they're deemed to be too provocative, mm-hmm. if they're violating dress code, if they're doing things that might lead to some other understandings about the ways in which girls are supposed to behave or the ways that girls are supposed to dress, or, you know, if they're too loud in the hallway or, engaging in cultural norms around the vocal expression, right, that seem to be disruptive or that are interpreted by others as, you know, sort of being a challenge to authority, then they tend to also be targeted under these policies. And these are things that we don't necessarily talk about because it doesn't give us the visual image of a kid being hauled off in handcuffs, right, which
right.
is atrocious and, you know, certainly traumatizes us all. So, but even, you know, the ways in which we might routinely engage in some of these acts against youth or in you know, what one might consider to be a microaggression, right, around mm-hmm. how we're feeling about their place and space in schools, all lead to how they then interpret their value in society, what they're supposed to do, how they're supposed to act, what they're supposed to say. And so, you know, it's really important for us to talk about those things and to also talk about those boys and girls who are being educated in correctional facilities and detention facilities who are often not a part of our narrative around the reach of the justice system and the way that it is impacting the learning of our young people and their promise for future development.
Are there other institutions that need to come on board and address some of these issues outside of the schools?
Yes. The healthcare industry needs to be a much more dominant force, I would say, in the conversations about the health of our children. We tend to focus on physical health. There have been national initiatives that are looking at obesity, for example, which is tied to other, you know, sort of chronic diseases. But it's also important to talk about mental health conditions and the ways in which our young people are expressing and engaging around this question of stress. And I think in general, we don't spend a lot of time talking about our stresses, right? We don't
right.
spend a lot of time talking about our mental health. We kind of avoid that conversation in favor of other conversations. But I think the health industry, health community needs to be much more engaged in these conversations. It's also, the faith community and the foundation philanthropic community have also been engaged in conversations about males and you know, it's you know, all been important work. You know, I'm one to say that I understand that there has been an investment in the conditions of our males. I get that. But we can't do it to the exclusion of our females because they do have some unique ways in which they express. And we have to engage them in this conversation if we're really going to engage in a full, holistic community development strategy.
As growing up in an African-American family, we all know about the talk that fathers have with their sons. Should fathers and mothers also have the talk with their daughters?
We do. We absolutely do. You know, it's important because people have talked about, especially, you know, after Trayvon Martin, there was a lot of conversation about the talk, right, about racism, about how one engages with law enforcement. And, you know, families are having these same conversations with girls, or they should be having the same conversations with girls,
mm-hmm.
except that, you know, what's missing from most of the talks with males that should also be there for males and that is missing, you know, or that needs to be a part of the conversation for females is this intersection between, you know, addressing sexism and
right,
racism.
Right.
And we have to talk about it in real terms. We have to talk about the ways in which, you know, our language, our structures, our expectations are all, you know, sort of impacted by the ways that we understand the relationships between males and females. And so when we're talking to girls about being able to recognize and behave in ways that protect them, we also have to be very clear about the ways in which patriarchy informs how males interact with females, how they're absorbing these messages through popular culture, how they're receiving these messages even in schools and in normal interactions with each other, and how it's playing out in our families and in our communities. So the talk with girls is not just about racism, it's also about sexism and internalized oppression. And these are the things that we need to really drive home for both males and females, because talking about sexism only with females is not as helpful as talking about it with both males and females. And again, this is part of, you know, why I think it's really critical and important for our narratives around community investment and really supporting kids who are at highest risk of failure or traumatization, you know, et cetera, are really, you know, we really must deal with both males and females. and youth who don't conform to, you know, one particular gender identity.
I know that's right. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio, and we're speaking with Dr. Monique W. Morris, co-founder and president of the National Black Women's Justice Institute and author of Black Stats, African Americans by the Numbers in the 21st Century. Dr. Morris, when did you come up with the idea of putting this book together?
Well, it started a little over a year ago when trying to construct a narrative about sort of where we were, what was our status. And as a researcher, I have spent several years just pulling data, trying to situate Black people and Black America in conversations in various disciplines, right, in conversations about justice and equality. And it occurred to me, you know, certainly in my time at the NAACP, but even prior to that, that there needed to be a resource that allows us to sort of at a glance understand or at least position our conversations or anchor our conversations about where our people are showing up on various issues, right? Both in terms of representation, but also in terms of opinion. Like, what do we think about some of these big policy issues? How are we engaged in these issues? How are these, you know, social policies affecting our communities? And so I wanted to create a document that allows us to position that conversation and launch conversations. So that's one of the things that, you know, we say in this book, both, you know, Dr. Muhammad in the introduction and me throughout the book, is that the statistics are intended to anchor a conversation and to launch community conversations about, you know, when and where we enter in these spaces, right, how we enter these spaces, not necessarily to be, you know, where we end a conversation. And so people look at statistics as, you know, case closed, here's the stat, et cetera. And it's important to, you know, consider what stats can tell us about conditions and what they can't tell us about conditions, right? They anchor a conversation and help to launch our understanding and further exploration of a particular issue, not necessarily, you know, close the case for us, especially on some of the big issues that I introduce in this book, like Black public opinion on crime and safety,
right,
Black public opinion on stand your ground, or some of the issues having to do with health, having to do with the environment, about the extent to which Black people even know about, you know, definitions of key environmental, you know, issues or environmental instruments, you know. So, you know, as we engage in these conversations, what I wanted to do was prevent a statistical narrative to anchor our conversations and launch them throughout the country.
You mentioned Manny Marble reminding us about history is not all about time long past, but understanding contemporary Black history is crucial,
yes,
to understanding our collective experiences and our intersections with public policy. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Yes. So Dr. Marable was my mentor for several years,
right,
when I was at Columbia University, and I feel very blessed to have had that experience of interacting with him. And I actually thank you for bringing him into this conversation, because I did dedicate this book to him because much of what I know and understand about research came from him,
mm-hmm,
came from his understanding about how we position ourselves as academics, and how if we are going to engage in conversations about the status and story of our people, we must absolutely maintain a connection to our people, right? So research can't be about, you know, an external person looking in, but we have to understand our place within and engage in a way that not only represents our story and struggle through a Black and white lens of history, but rather engage in a connection between what is currently happening in our communities,
right,
with the historical construct that helps to inform the way that we engage in our communities, such that we can enact policies and practices, you know, sort of policy with the big P, if we think about federal, state, you know, policies,
right,
but also policy with a little p, right? How,
right,
we're going to move forward in our institutions and our agencies in a way that really is about the development of our people. But ultimately, what this was about is the lesson of leading with love, right?
Right.
These are lessons that have come, you know, that are part of our ancestral engagement in this work. You know, most of the names that we could rattle off of scholars who have engaged in work in the exploration of Black people, it's been about exploring our community because we love it. We love our people. And so that ultimately, I think, should lead this conversation.
I also was interested in W.E.B. Du Bois. I think he may have been the first scholar to actually use statistics back in the day, but when he used statistics, it was almost thrown back in his face.
Yes. So Dr. Muhammad talks a bit about that in the introduction and about the ways in which Du Bois was able to construct narratives using statistical data that, because of the social orientation of the day, did harm in some ways,
right,
to, you know, our conversations about the status of Black America. It's always a troubling space when you present statistics, and for that reason, many people try to stay away from them, right? You know, you don't want to see a narrative about being overrepresented in conditions of harm or in spaces that are harmful and underrepresented in spaces that are healthy, even though that's important to understanding what is happening in our communities and understanding how far we have to go in constructing, you know, a full agenda that represents the promise of, you know, full inclusion, right? That said, it's important that these statistics, you know, just because, I mean, you know, Du Bois had the question about how to collect stats and how to engage in a conversation using data, and he did start to move toward qualitative data, right? The stories, the narratives, and I think he experimented in many ways with the ways in which we tell our stories, such that we don't just use one form, you know, of understanding what's happening. And that's something that I draw attention to. Even though the title is Black Stats, there is some narrative here,
right,
to help shape our understanding and interpretation of data. So while Du Bois, you know, was certainly a, you know, someone who used data, who relied on data, and then, you know, moved away from data, statistical
mm-hmm.
data at least, to help inform discussions about the conditions of Black America, they still remained a part of our consciousness. They're a part of our American culture of understanding conditions, and numbers are not going to go anywhere. They
right.
can reflect the questions that have been asked already,
mm-hmm.
which is something that I say in the book, right? They can help us understand at least relationships between what's happening in communities or what's happening between issues in certain communities, and all of that is important. But again, they can only tell us so much. So it's important for us to use these data as a launching pad, right, for conversations, new questions, new explorations about how we engage in the full development of Black America.
How did you go about finding the quotes you began each section with?
I've known of many of these quotes. These are some of my favorite quotes.
Okay.
From these,
so you got a chance to use them.
I did. I, you know, that part was the fun part for me, because
okay.
I do, you know, I think it's probably because of my time spent with Manning, you
mm-hmm.
know, to really pull upon the words and frameworks of, you know, some people who I consider my heroes. You know, Dr. Bullard, who's been engaged in environmental justice for years, Dr. Davis, who, you know, and most people know just as Angela Davis. You know, her critique of the justice system has
right.
long been a part of the narrative. June Jordan, you know, who many, you know, Black feminists know and understand in terms of her contribution to how we construct identity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are some of the voices that I just wanted to lift up, you know, shout out in this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Frederick Douglass, certainly, you know, as someone who not only engaged in, you know, conversations about the disenfranchisement of Black people, but was also a feminist. I mean, I just think there are so many ways in which our history represents our, you know, our promise for the future, right? This concept of Sankofa. You got to know what has come before you in order to move forward. So it was an opportunity for me to share some of my favorite quotes and discussions.
I understand. We're going to go through some of the chapters. There's no way we can fully go through the whole book, because we don't have time, and I wish I could. But why was it important for you, as you had mentioned earlier, to frame each chapter with a narrative to give the reader an idea of what these numbers represent from a historical perspective?
Again, because I believe in this concept of Sankofa. I really do believe that you must understand the context and history
okay.
of a particular issue in order for you to make meaning of what's happening today and what's possible for the future. So while every introduction is not necessarily, you know, an historical one, some of them, you know, sort of, or some of them might be more, you know, about the contemporary history, as I was talking about before, right, where these are things that are part of our modern understanding,
right,
but that also just give us an opportunity to think about the stats a little bit differently and within the context of building a promising racial justice and social justice agenda, which is ultimately, you know, what I hope will come from this work. So it was important, you know, even in the cases where there might be statistics presented that by themselves might be confusing or by themselves might feel disconnected to the broader narrative, I wanted to provide some information about why they were included here.
Obviously, in reading the book, there was a natural order, I assume, and education was one of the first sections in which you wrote about, since education has always been drummed into us as African Americans, been the linchpin to success, upward mobility, et cetera, et cetera. There aren't many of us as educators, either on the elementary, secondary, or on the collegiate level. Is that a concern that you have?
Yes, it is. You know, I start the chapter with Malcolm X's quote, "Education is the passport to the future, for tomorrow belongs to those who prepare for it today." And I started with that because I think there's sort of a dual narrative happening in the education chapter.
Mm-hmm.
I begin the chapter by talking about, you know, the tremendous success and dramatic increases from 1970,
right,
of Black Americans age 25 and older who have a high school diploma and a college degree.
Right.
And those are things that I think we should celebrate. And, you know, again, while there are still, you know, relatively small percents of African Americans or numbers of African Americans who are getting advanced degrees or who are getting professional degrees, we're still in the game. You know what I mean? And so it's important for us to tell those stories of those individuals and to talk about those increases precisely because I do believe what we start with and how we engage is important to what we think is possible. There is an underrepresentation of Black Americans in teaching, and that is something that has been a part of the national narrative around how we prepare our young people. Michelle Foster has talked a bit about what might have been lost, you know, with, you know, some of the migration patterns and other opportunities, and I introduce language of other scholars who have been looking, other education scholars who have been looking at some of the problems associated with, you know, both the achievement opportunities for Black children and Black students, as well as some of the other trends that might be leading to the disproportionate underperformance and underrepresentation of teachers.
Dr. Monique W. Morris, co-founder and president of the National Black Women's Justice Institute and author of Black Stats, African Americans by the Numbers in the 21st Century. We will conclude our conversation on next week's program. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson, H-A-N-S-O-N, at KUT.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at KUT.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.